to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer. Our guest tonight is Kent Goulding, former backgammon expert and backgammon bookmaker, poker pro, and all-around Advantage player. We'll be talking to Kent shortly, I hope. 5 minutes ago, he said he's in a cab 4 minutes away, so we should be fine, but don't know for sure. For the past 2 weeks, I've been talking about a player who stiffed me financially. We played a promotion at the Parks Casino near Philadelphia. After we split our profits according to the agreed-upon formula, I went back to my hotel room, was getting undressed, and I found another slot ticket in my pocket for $2,500 that should have been part of the community property. I immediately called him up and told him about it, and we decided that he would pay me for the ticket. He'd give me $2,200 and keep $300 as his share of that, and that and everything was fine. The next morning came, and he drove me to another casino with a sign-up bonus. Finally, at the airport, he said now he's all of a sudden he didn't have the $2,200. But he promised to mail it to me. That was June 8th. To date, I've received $175 from him and several broken promises. On two occasions, he sent Western Union tracking numbers telling me to go in and pick up money. On both those occasions, it was a made-up number, and Western Union knew nothing about it. Once he supposedly sent me a certified letter. That never happened either. His name is Jeff Toll. Jeffrey Warren Toll, T-O-L-L. As far as I'm concerned, he's lied to me numerous times and cheated me out of money. I'm talking about his theft tonight, and we'll be devoting my next Tuesday's blog about him as well. If he wishes to go after me for libel or slander for saying bad things about him, good luck. He can knock himself out. I have enough emails and texts from him to support the position. If you can find any way to avoid doing business with this guy, Jeffrey Warren Toll, you'd be better off for it. When it's time to talk to Kent, we'll be asking him how he dealt through the years with teammates and associates who cheated. For visitors coming to Las Vegas, there is now free Wi-Fi downtown. Apparently, it's a low-grade Wi-Fi, but it's free. And that's a plus to those who want and don't otherwise have access to free Wi-Fi. Do you ever stay downtown, Munchkin?
No, I haven't stayed downtown in a long time. But, I often see people asking on message boards about places to get Wi-Fi. And free Wi-Fi is a good thing. Google is talking about doing these high altitude balloons and putting Wi-Fi all over the United States. I mean, I think that would be a great thing. I wanted to just go back to your the guy who stiffed you.
Yes.
It is a problem that happens too often. In my case, you at least have the luxury of being able to expose the person on the air. In the past, when these things have happened, I've talked about it with other friends. What do you do? And, all of us, eventually, all you really can do is write it off. I wish there were a better solution.
Yes, I do too. We'll ask Kent about his experience. He's surely come into similar experiences through the years. Now, we've had some conversations with Bob Nersessian about traveling with money. Apparently, someone was traveling with $1 million in cash, stopped by the police for some reason, and this money was confiscated. Munch, why don't you tell us about this?
Well, you know, this is a problem that many blackjack players have run into. You know, there are these random stops on the highways across the United States, really where the police are just sniffing around for money or, you know, drugs. But in this particular case, it was a stripper who had managed to save over 15 years of stripping $1 million. According to the article, in $1 bills, but I think she had actually in the article it said that she had packaged the money in $10,000 bundles. So I assume she had converted all those dollars into hundreds. But anyway, yeah, she was stopped by the police. The police asked, "You don't mind if we search your car, do you?" And sure enough, they said yes. Actually, I'm sorry, the stripper was not the one driving. She had given the money to someone else, and they were going to buy a nightclub in New Jersey and were driving it cross country. Anyway, they found $1 million in the trunk, confiscated the money, and the good news is that the courts said, no, you have to give her the money back. That there were drug-sniffing dogs that found trace amounts of drugs on the money, but the judge said that was inconsequential. So the good news is that the wealthy stripper got all her money back. We're happy for her.
Good.
Oh, and they had to pay interest.
Well, good. Now, Richard, I want you to promise me that if you ever decide to travel with $1 million in cash, that you won't be going with a stripper while you're doing it. Will you promise that, Richard?
Yes, I can definitely promise that. I'm sure my wife would not be happy with me you know, traveling with a stripper and $1 million in cash.
All right. Well, Kent's in the studio now. I guess I could extract that promise from him too if I had to. All right. Now the Revel has made the news again. While their play for free promotion has been getting trashed in the player press, the casino is now also being trashed in the regular press by ploppies who didn't read the rules. What did you make of this one, Richard?
Well, you know, this one I was of mixed feelings. You know, I actually think the ploppies really have nothing to complain about. I mean, if you try to play a promotion of any kind, you know, even if it's in your grocery store, it's up to you to read the rules. And, of course, it's going to be fine print. And I don't care how fine it is, you know, anybody should realize they have to read fine print. The thing about I'm happy about it, though, is that that Revel is getting more bad press. I just wish I think it's one thing to get bad press from Advantage players, which I guess the hotel probably doesn't care that much about, but I'm sure they care a lot more about getting bad press from the very people that they're trying to attract.
Yeah, these are slot players who, and they don't want to go to the Revel, then the Revel is in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely.
While we're in Atlantic City, the Borgata had some interesting news. Apparently, there were some cocktail waitresses who gained a few extra pounds. Borgata says you can't work here anymore. Cocktail waitress goes to court. What happened, Richard?
Well, it was 22 cocktail waitresses who are called Borgata Babes.
Borgata
right?
Babes.
Now, if you're Borgata Babes. Now, if you're going to apply for a job as a Borgata Babe, you know, you have to understand what it is you're getting in for. But anyway, I guess they were having problems where, you know, if they would gain 7%, you know, of their body weight, they were fired. Anyway, they filed a suit, and the judge ruled that, no, that the Borgata had the right, that these were both cocktail servers and entertainers, and they knew what they were signing up for in the beginning, and the Borgata had the right to fire them.
As a civil libertarian, I'm kind of feel the girls got a bad deal. As a male pig, I think I'm glad they have good looking cocktail waitresses.
I remember 30 years ago, the Culinary Union in Las Vegas was very strong, and some of those 70-year-old women in those skimpy outfits were pretty awful to look at.
They don't look any better today. There's something, you go to the Riviera and none of the cocktail waitresses there were born after 1950. And, but apparently there's this union and they can't get rid of them. Anyway, enough about that. Let's talk to Kent Goulding. Why don't you introduce him to us, Munchkin?
Okay. Well, Kent, I first met over 30 years ago. He was a top backgammon player for probably the last 30 years. Wrote the best backgammon magazine ever with Bill Roberti called Inside Backgammon. Wrote, I guess you would call, it was a quarterly periodical called Backgammon with the Masters, which was one of the first really good analysis of matches. Anyway, he's moved on to poker and slots and video poker and all kinds of other advantage play. So, Kent, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Very good. And I'm glad that taxi driver made it here. Now, we mentioned the Revel. You live sort of near Atlantic City, so you've been in touch with a number of players who played during the July Revel promotion. What's your take so far?
Well, I've been somewhat distant. As it was brewing in late June, several pretty big players got in touch with me and proposed some propositions where we actually went at it tooth and claw. And then, you know, the night before July came about, it was clear the casino was taking some sort of countermeasures. So the people who were going to be doing the playing sat back and sort of kept an eye on it and watched and got spooked. So there was enough decarding and enough wise guys in there misbehaving that the casino clearly was not of a mind to tolerate potential new big customers that appeared as though they were just taking advantage of the game. So my involvement basically ended before it began. I did have one associate who has played. I think he set a relatively small target on the upside and was prepared to lose a relatively small amount of the downside, I think 15 or 20,000. I believe he lost that. Got no heat from the casino. I think he played, there was a Keno game which attracted some attention, and he played some on relatively high denomination slot machines. They lost their 15 or 20,000, and now we're waiting to see if there's any hassles getting the rebate when August rolls around.
Very good.
I think if he actually got the play in, I think he's in good shape. Once you get the play in, I don't think it'll be pretty hard for them to try to deny him payment. And if they do, from what Bob Nersessian said, he'll probably have a very good lawsuit.
Right. I don't know if how much the lawsuit is worth carrying on or how deeply you want to get into it. The guy who actually did the play, my friend is not a local, but the guy who did the playing is a friend of his who is a local. There's another guy I've done business with over the years who had planned to hit it very big and go for a pretty big target and was willing to lose $100,000, as were several of us. He backed off and he has a local address, and his plan was to do something similar. I haven't been in touch with him in the last week or two. My friend who actually played said they got no heat. It's like the casino barely noticed they were there. You know, one of them was already a member of the slot club and was already, you know, sort of a low-level local, and I don't think they're going to have any hassle at all.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, I stayed away from it. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, we've beaten up the Revel enough times, so let's move on to something else. Now, surely you've had enough. You've had teammates who've stolen from you. You've been on enough associations or teams through the years. What do you do about it?
Well, my biggest defense to that, and I've been pretty good at it over, 30 plus years of professional gambling, and I've been running a very successful slot team for 29 years now, pretty much nonstop. My biggest defense was not to grow too fast and to try to have, well, originally it was just literally friends, close friends and relatives, and I had no problems whatsoever. And then as business got better, it became clear that if I had more people, I'd make more money. So I expanded, and we did have several relatively big problems, the biggest of which we were very, very busy for a bunch of years playing some high-limit stuff, and our players kept very accurate record how long they were there, how much money they spent. They were not directly supervised, which these days all of my players are. I supervise him, he supervises the other guy. They all keep the same very accurate records, but someone's looking over your shoulder. You say, I'm about to buy in for $1,000. Someone else records that along with you. So we clamped down some after some unsavory incidents. The biggest one was a guy who had played for me regularly, who'd done very well, was a very profitable player. He was not a close friend, but was a friend of a friend. And through amassing a fair amount of playing data, you know, our internal affairs division flagged him as some of his results look suspicious. His results on the outside, say playing high-end video poker, looked fine for the amount of time he played, but we didn't, you know, he was playing a lot in areas where there wasn't a player card, so we couldn't measure the points he played. So we had time and we had drop, and all that matched up pretty well. Then we started digging deeper and matching up drop to low-end W2Gs, like you know, a straight flush or a four of a kind, which generated W2G. And there, the frequency of the low-end W2Gs was way, way, way off. It turns out what we're now 99.9% certain he was doing is basically not actually playing. You know, he would be part of a group. We might have had 10, 15 people going after the same target, and he would basically sit on his hands or pretend to be pushing, but wouldn't be pushing, would submit his records, and, you know, with commensurate drop, which looked fine at first blush. Only when we matched up his drop against his W2G frequency did we catch him. Then we started trying to watch more closely, and we did a bunch of statistical analysis and came to the inescapable conclusion that he was rotten. We think he probably, over a period of close to a year, he probably ripped us off for somewhere in the area of $100,000 in bits and pieces. He became aware that we were getting suspicious, and, you know, conveniently found reasons to seek employment elsewhere and move back to China, where his parents had come from. He never did any of that, but he did. Well, he disappeared from us. And we consulted a number of lawyers, and the answer was pretty much always the same. Yes, you've got excellent statistical evidence that the guy's a cheat. You know, he's embezzling. It's all illegal. You're never going to get any criminal prosecutor to do anything about it, because they're going to look at this and just say it's gamblers cheating gamblers. We're not going to waste public money on this. So you've got a civil suit, but you've got to decide how catchable he is, what judgment you could actually get, and how much you want to expose your business to all the scrutiny. And so we basically let it go.
Wrote it off.
Yeah. It was, it rankles me to this day. We had one episode of a not terribly trustworthy person that we were trying to keep an eye on, and he traditionally played a certain type of game, and all his records seemed in order, and we kept a reasonably close eye on him. And then one evening we switched to a different casino and a different kind of game, and when it was over, he submitted his records, and the rate of loss was commensurate with the amount of time he would have played on the game he was used to, but was grossly out of whack for the game he was actually playing. And we never actually saw him again. That was the end of him. He just disappeared into thin air. And I think he got away with $10,000 or $15,000, and we were aware of it. He was aware of it, but we don't know where he went, and I don't know what we'd have done to him, even if we'd caught up with him anyway. So one or two instances, one pretty big one. There was a third of a guy I'd actually trusted for years, but he actually had one of the things I've done throughout all these years is key people, well-trained, frequently available people, I've encouraged to take a small stake in the business. So they weren't just, you know, contract laborers or employees, they were actually, at least partially, owner operators. And whenever I had a partner as such, they would have a share of our operating bankroll, which was often in the millions of dollars. So even a small share is tens of thousands. And we did have an incident with one guy who, again, statistically didn't match up. And we had a couple of eyewitness situations, which really were pretty close to catching his hand in the till, but we couldn't prove just how much, how often. It was just that it was pretty clearly a problem here. And, you know, our lawyer talked to him, and we basically said, why don't you take this time to, you know, retire from the business, and your stake in the bankroll will be left behind, and no one will accuse anybody of anything, and that'll be that. So we probably got modest restitution by keeping his stake in the business and letting him walk away.
Well, let's try to talk about happier subjects.
Yeah, good idea.
Now, backgammon. I first heard your name 30 years ago when you published the Backgammon with the Champion series of annotated matches. And I was at that time, I was probably at the high end of the ploppy scale in terms of backgammon ability. I was a club-level player at the Cavendish in the Los Angeles area. And I learned a lot from your books. So I haven't played in 20 years. When did you give up backgammon, or did you?
Well, give it up is probably an overstatement, but I became way, way less active. I mean, backgammon was, you know, my sort of side life. I mean, for a good part of 30 years, that really is what I lived for. I mean, I had a family, I had a wife, I had a daughter, I had a job, if you call, you know, a professional slot player a job. But backgammon was my passion. And two things happened. One is a very good client slash friend of mine, a very wealthy gentleman who loved to play with good players, and particularly me, got sick and passed away. So that cut some of the financial incentive away. And the poker boom came. And all of a sudden, I'm turning on the TV and seeing friends of mine, guys I hadn't seen in years, who used to be top-level backgammon players that hadn't been showing up at backgammon tournaments, and they're on TV playing poker, and all of a sudden they're rock stars. They're
Seidel and Paul McGrill.
Eric Seidel and Paul McGrill and Jason Lester, and there's a whole slew. Phil Lack, I mean, Gus Hansen, yeah. No, I was... you know, pretty friendly with Gus Hansen in a lot of ways when he played backgammon, and saw him a little bit at poker, but, you know, he had kind of gone his way and I had gone mine. So basically I saw this and I said, well, how hard could this be? If all these bozos can do it, surely I can do it too. Now, they had a big head start on me. I'd really never played poker before.
Well, the bozos he's talking about, the average IQ is about 180 in that list of bozos. But go ahead.
No, they're among the general game-playing population, they're fringe characters. And, you know, the general game-playing population are probably, the average dude is probably a fringe player to the general population. At least in terms of mental capacity. Some of their common sense may be lacking. Some of their ability to exist in what we would call the real world is certainly lacking. But so I said, oh, I'm gonna try this poker stuff. And at the time, of course, online poker was going absolutely nuts. So I had some of my old backgammon buddies would help me with poker. I actually became, over the past 10 years, closer with, Quack Quack Paul McGrill than I had been in the previous 25 years at backgammon. And we were friends and associates, but I spent a lot more time with Paul learning and practicing poker than I did playing backgammon with him. And I very, very quickly, particularly with the ability to play online, you know, day and night, applied whatever game-playing skills I have, even though I was a bit of a codger, to... learning poker, and it did pretty well. I did very well online. I managed to satellite my way into virtually any, you know, $10,000 plus entry fee tournament they were running satellites for. I got into usually at far less expense than it would have cost me to shell out the cash, and I've had a pretty good time with it for the last 10 years. And that, given that I'm also trying to lead a normal life, you know, my spare time for game playing was much more focused on poker and backgammon. I had to take a second seat.
Are you more of a tournament player or more of a cash game player?
Pretty much 100% tournament player.
Yeah. You know, the other thing about backgammon, I mean, I got out of it for two reasons. Number one, there just is not the money in backgammon that there is in almost anything else. And the other thing that, for me, really bothered me was the opponents that are the most profitable to play against are often just awful human beings, and I didn't want to spend time with them, even though it might be profitable.
Yeah, there is some of that. I may have a slightly different view of a lot of the strange characters you meet at backgammon tournaments. I mean, years ago, someone was interviewing me about what I saw in backgammon tournaments, and I said, well, it's sort of like going to the zoo. There's all kinds of, or going into one of these bars from Star Wars or whatever. There's all these strange characters you meet that really you got to wonder if they're actually human. And I was fascinated by some of these people, particularly since some of them really are statistical outliers intellectually, but they're also statistical outliers socially. So I thought that was an absolute hoot.
I like the eccentricity. It was the people who were abusive that, you know, really bothered me.
Yeah, well, I stayed, I picked my spots and tried to stay away from as many of those guys as I could. I mean, I did have some friends / clients who I was not in any way hustling that were well-heeled. They liked to play big, big side action, and they liked to play with me. And they could lose, a substantial sum of money over the course of a weekend while we're at it. I mean, the tournament was sort of an excuse to get together, wherever it might be, whether it was Istanbul or Prague or Baltimore. You know, as long as we were together, we'd have our own fun. And, if I beat him 9 out of 10 weekends out of 50, 100,000 or whatever, and then one weekend he beat me out of 10,000, he'd be tickled pink for months. And that's the kind of guy I like.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, backgammon has had a number of cheating scandals. Sometimes magnetized dice, sometimes players tanking due to bets with bookies, sometimes players being served Mickeys so they couldn't play well. In Las Vegas, there was sort of a backgammon mob boss, and if you wanted to play in Vegas, you had to deal with him. Do you have a theory why there's so much cheating, relatively speaking, in backgammon compared to other gambling games?
Well, no, I don't. I suppose it's sort of a fringe game, and there really isn't any strong oversight to it. It's pretty much self-policing, or has been at most of the tournaments I've been at. For a number of years, the Monte Carlo World Championship was more than self-policing. They had, they had the Monte Carlo authorities on your side, provided. Now, being on your side meant being on the Monte Carlo authorities' side, and their views of what was fair and what wasn't fair more depended on who was doing it as opposed to what they were doing. So when I actually got, for a number of years, the most exciting and juicy concession of being their official fixed odds bookie, we'd have pre-tournament meetings and they'd say, well, is there anybody in Monte Carlo that we should show the border to? Anybody, that you need us to get rid of? And I would invariably say, no, but I do want to keep an eye perhaps on several people. And the biggest challenge to me as a bookie there, the lines we made were pretty outrageous. The players had huge egos, or there were also many bettors who just wanted to bet on their favorite. They always, almost invariably, picked the chalk and, the short odds players, and we made the odds absurdly short and still took in lots of money. The biggest challenge.
So if Paul McGreal, if a fair price on him was 50-1, I don't know, what would
he'd jump at the chance to get in at 10-1. And their egos would really, really get in the way. I don't know how many of these guys believe they were that good. I mean, how can you have 15 guys who all think they're 10-1 in a field of 200? But that's kind of what I was. I mean, it was, in a certain sense, it was taking candy from, I won't call them babies, but, from highly egotistical people.
And you got paid up front.
It was listed as ante-post. Buy your ticket up front, and it was almost always win only betting. So throughout the course of the week, we're taking bets, but only the people who bought the winner get paid. And the biggest challenge there, I mean, you can always get unlucky. They can we would change odds to try to balance the book as best we could, but it's never really balanced. There's always a heavy betting on some of the chalk, or some pigeon would be out there really wanting to make a big score. And that to me was the biggest danger. The guy who, you know, we put up at 100-1, who's basically dead money, but now he wants to bet a couple $1,000s on himself. You know, now you got to be very, very careful, because a player who may be, you know, dead money from a backgammon skill standpoint, may be anything but dead money with other resources, buying off his opponent, magnetic dice, all the manner of cheating you can possibly imagine.
Or slipping Mickeys too.
A good friend of mine basically woke up in a hospital in the middle of a key match.
His first name wouldn't be Mike, would it?
Yes, it would. Yes.
Somebody from Vegas was never accused of doing it, were they? We'll go on.
Yeah.
He's dead anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that guy's gone. What I actually did is I had several defense mechanisms. One is there were several very knowledgeable players with the international crowd. The Americans, I knew top to bottom. I mean, they're basically, for a number of years, I ran the international backgammon rating list. I had a huge database of results of all the tournaments, you know, who beat who, when, how long was the match, et cetera, and ran it through, you know, an ELO-type chess rating formula, and had ratings for all the players. So, and I could use those numbers when handicapping Monte Carlo. I even had a early computer program where I could punch the ratings in and all the players once the draw sheet was made, and it would spit out what each player's chances were of winning. You know, how nifty is that? This is before, you know, there were really computers everywhere, but I had a computer and we used it. My biggest threat was, the guys who'd, and one bookie after I retired got burned because they ended up with a key match between people who knew each other. And I don't even think one of them had to buy the other off. One of them had a huge bet with a book. The other didn't. So guess which one was going to win? They're probably splitting the money anyway. So they had 100% incentive to arrange that player A won, and zero incentive for player B to win. And the bookie got stung. So what I did is, as the week progressed and as the bets came in, had scouts identifying potentially dangerous players from either a cheating standpoint, or maybe because I'd mishandicapped them. And I'd let my scouts get a minimum bet down on the target guy and figure it was a good price to pay to be alerted. And then I would set the odds for the suspected creative player, we'll call him, resourceful player. I'd set the odds to attract some of their money, get them to bet, you know, maybe several hundred dollars or whatever, and then cut them off and change the odds. So now they've got a $30,000 ticket if they win the event, but my handle was probably over 100,000. So if they win the event, I pay out 30 to their bet and keep the other 70. So effectively, they're now working for me. So, you know, I'm not rooting for them to go out and cheat people, but if they do, it's actually helping me as opposed to hurting me. So that was, in terms of the book in Monte Carlo, that's the way I attempted to work around it. And it worked pretty well.
I wanted to talk about some of the promotions that you've played, because a lot of times, crazy thing, we were talking about Revel earlier, but so you played some promotion up in Caesars Tahoe?
Oh, that was an early one. I think it was 1992, maybe, and we were really hungry back then. We were looking for anything we could do, and we were taking advantage of all kinds of good stuff. And we had, Caesars back then had plenty of jacks are better 9-6 machines of multiple denominations, and what by today's standards would be a massively liberal cashback percentage. I think it was like 0.625% or something. So these games are, for a well-trained player, you know, marginally plus when you count in your cashback. And they had their TGIF promotion. Thank God it's Friday, where every Friday they were giving double points. Now, that's nice, but we were real busy, and, you know, Tahoe's a long way from the East Coast where most of our business was.
Well, but what size machines? Now, double points, so if you're talking about now 0.7 advantage,
Well, it gets better.
Well, yeah, but even so, if you're talking about $25 machines, that's big. If you're talking about $1 machines, it's
not
worth
it. They had $25 machines, at least. And we had a couple of guys who'd been chasing a progressive pot down in Reno when I got a call from someone who actually worked in a back office at Caesars in their advertising or promotions. I don't remember what function she held. And she said, hey, they're about to launch a, starting next week or the day after tomorrow or something, they're going to launch a bring a friend promotion.
Uh-huh. How does this work?
Well, it means if you bring a friend who's new to their system, whatever that person plays for some limited period of time, but it wasn't in hours. I think it was measured in days. Whatever points they earn get matched on your account. So if you happen to bring in a new friend on a Friday where they're doing double points.
And only play on the friend's card.
And the friend plays on the friend's card if he's well-trained. Then you are basically getting quadruple points. And they happen to have a 3-coin, $100 6-9 machine with a $2,500 fixed jackpot on it. Now, we had two guys in Reno.
$250,000,
excuse me.
Okay, where normal would be only $240,000.
Yeah, we had a little extra juice on top of that.
That's not a major decision, but
now you've got a game which is, slightly better than your normal jacks.
Right, it's 99.6.
Well, you got a little player error. I mean, not all my players play it. Few humans can play under duress with slightly overweight, gorgeous cocktail waitresses running around and casino bosses patting them on the back and all the distractions you get. So we had two guys in Reno who had actually just hit some $5 progressive pot they had down there. I don't remember what it was for. They were getting ready to go home. I said, hold it. Can you stay over a day? And one of them had a record at Caesars and one of them had never played there before. So the guy who'd never played there before was about 6'4 and 240. So we decided to nickname him Mr. Big.
Okay.
They had a jackpot check from having hit this, $5 progressive, which they took to the bank and cashed. I told him to trade in their rent-a-rec for a new model, Lincoln or Cadillac. I had the guy who had a record there, mainly as a $5 player, sometimes playing 25s, and there'd be little things going on where we might do the double points if we had somebody there anyway and on a $25 machine and take our 0.7 or 0.6 or whatever we figured it to be. And now we figure how can we get Mr. Big in and not raise red flags like people saw it in the Atlantic City promotion or in many other promotions. So most of my approach to a lot of these promotions, as opposed to sneaking up on them or trying to skulk in and skulk out, is to advertise my presence, come in the front door, and let them wonder what exactly they've got their hands on. Is this a high roller who's getting lucky or playing the right game, or is this some what you guys would call advantage player? And if you have the right guy in the right circumstances, the casinos aren't sure, and sometimes they're willing to throw out some flowers with the weeds, and sometimes they're more interested in this might be a really good flower. We'll take a chance that he's a weed. So my guy with a record there called his host. I mean, he was a big enough player that he had a host, et cetera. He'd get comp rooms. He said, I'm going to be in town tomorrow. I've got a friend of mine from back east who's become disillusioned with Atlantic City. We're sort of doing a tour of Nevada, checking out casinos. He's a cash player. Do you have a nice suite you can put him in? He'll put up some front cash and see if he likes to play there. And the host said, well, yeah, we can give him whatever suite you want, but I can't guarantee we're going to comp. And my, player B, Sleepy was his nickname. Sleepy said, no, it's fine. Mr. Big will pay it. If he doesn't like the action, he's happy to pay for his room. That's not a problem. And Sleepy said, I'll be there, around noon tomorrow with Roger. And, I'll see you when we get there. And then he called again as he was nearing the casino, called his host and said, hey, we're arriving. You want to meet us at the cage or whatever? And, drove the Cadillac up to the valet.
The Cadillac up to the cage. Yes. I want to see that one.
Right. And now the host meets them at the cage as Roger is pulling wads of 10,000 out of a duffel bag and stacking them up in front of the cashier. And, you know, this is casinos like to see this, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't remember now.
As long as the straps don't say Harrah's Reno Allamer.
I think they ripped off the straps and put rubber bands on.
Okay.
And they could say Harrah's Reno because they were, you know, he said we're doing a tour of Nevada looking at this and looking at that. So, you know, Roger was a bit of a uncultured guy, but that's what he was supposed to be. You know, he liked to play golf, so he claims, oh, yeah, I like to play a lot of golf. Well, what do you do for a living? Well, I manage my grandpa's money. How's your grandpa doing? Oh, he died years ago. You know, one of these kind of deals, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in fact, the guy's destitute, but we weren't. And Sleepy and Roger are wandering around with the host, and the host is saying nice things. So, well, show me what you got. What can I play? Well, what do you like to play? I like to play slot machines. I like to play video poker. And he shows them around. Now, we knew they had this three-coin $100 game there. But he does a little tour, and he gets into the high limit area. What's this? This is $250,000. What do I got to do to win that? Well, you got to hit a royal flush. That's it? I hit a royal flush, and you give me $250,000? And the host says, yeah, of course, that's it. He says, will you feed me at the machine? This kind of caught him off guard. What do you mean, will you feed me? We prompted him with this. These are the kind of things that, you know, your average, Vegas scumbag doesn't think of. You know, they want to sneak in and try to do something and look furtive, look like a little weasel. So, no, we're going to give the casino something to think about, and they're not quite going to know what they got their hands on. So the guy said, well, normally we don't play food here, but we could arrange to bring you food here if you'd like. And he said, well, that's what I want to do. Let me get checked into my room, and I want to come down here. And they loved him. He played, they went through at some point. Sleepy said, oh, shouldn't we get Roger in the slot club? Oh, yeah, good idea. Come on over here. We'll join up whatever the slot club's called. There's a little line there. They cut the line, and the host says, here, sign up, Mr. Big here. And they sign him up. And then as the host and Roger are leaving the booth, Sleepy says to the guy, oh, and, you know, work in the booth sort of after Roger and the host are stepping away, and put me on there as a bring a friend. Oh, yes, of course, sir, we'll do that. And so now he's in. And Roger was the first person there. He actually didn't hit the royal. I mean, we had only on Fridays are we getting the huge juice. But Roger proved that we could get away with it. And he did okay. I think he actually was lucky enough on the drop that we beat the game that day. Of course, his very nice suite was comped and all the food and stuff. I think both he and Sleepy gained a few pounds. And then we trickled in some more people. One of our best players had a wife who'd never been in there. Now, she could barely play, but with the two of them together, I'm bringing my wife. This is a bring a friend. She wants to play. Okay, we'll do it. And we did some play with some other players less visible on the lower end. And at the end of the month, I think they took the $100 machine and threw it in Lake Tahoe. We never saw it again. We hit at least one royal, and we came damn near beating the drop on top of it. We collected 70-odd thousand in cash back and made a bunch, and it was an absolute hoot.
And Tahoe's a lovely area to play in.
Oh, it was spectacular.
It's God's country up there.
They had a deal where, you know, for every 1,000 points you get on your player card, they give you, a Caesars Tahoe coffee mug or whatever. We didn't take any coffee mugs, but I believe I calculated we were entitled to something like 50 to 100,000 coffee mugs.
I would think after 30,000 it'd get kind of boring.
Yeah. Well, that was, I mean,
you could sell them on eBay for years.
Even playing slow and eating sloppy Joe sandwiches and drinking beer with a little table they rolled up next to the machine, this was easily a $2,000 an hour opportunity, and we got a fair number of hours in, and we're lucky on top of it. So that was
Of course, on a three-coin $100 machine, you every time you get a straight or higher.
They run a tab. They just got someone there that just runs a tab.
Good. So they had the super system back in 92.
Well, on on request, you know, for special customers, they could streamline things so it went faster than it would if you just walked in. And that's what, you know, I've found over and over and over again that coming in the front door and showing them you're a high-end player as best you can and give them a reason to want your business and wonder what they've really got works far more often than it doesn't. We had a guy in, there was a game, I think it was at the Hilton years ago, they stuck in some kind of video poker variant, I've forgotten the name of it, which you could basically beat off the top, plus they had cash back. We thought this was pretty nice, and they had like $5, $25, and $100. And we were kind of moderately, and my ex-wife and I came in and played some. We had a record there. They knew us. You know, I credit there. So they viewed me as a high-end player from out of town, a relatively high-end player that they sort of wanted my business, they thought. You know, they'd treat us well. And we did some nibbling away at the $5 and $25 game, and another associate of mine would come in separately, maybe once a month, and wail on the $100 game. And he was one of the smoothest talkers we had. He was, at the time, you know, well, he still is, like 10 years older than the rest of us, and we were little twerps looking like we were out there to take advantage of somebody. And he had, the best patter you can imagine. He'd get along with them. He sounded like he belonged there betting a lot of money. And they shut down the games and stopped offering the $5 and $25. But when he came to town, which would be once every month or 6 weeks, they'd set up the $100 machine. They'd rope it off. They'd put out an order. When he showed up, he'd play. And when he went home, they'd take it away. And they couldn't make up their mind, was this a fat, juicy winner, or was this a wise guy? So they let it go for a while. And I think he eventually decided, this is getting a little, I don't want to do it anymore. We've done well. Let me bow out before I really blow my cover. And the next thing that comes along, they don't catch me on. And there were, you know, there was less than there is now, but there were certainly, forums and chat rooms or web pages devoted to advantage players. And we just had the greatest time listening to the people bellyache and complain about some rich guy who came in to play this game and they wouldn't let anybody else play it and how unfair that was. And even the advantage players didn't realize what this guy was. And
I think a lot of people underestimate the value of a good BP. They are worth their weight in gold.
Agreed. We're going to cut this off now. We have some commercials and a few other things. Kent, we got about a third of the way through the questions we had to ask you. You have to come back. No is not an acceptable answer.
Well, I can answer all kinds of questions you guys haven't even asked yet.
Well, good. Good. So it sounds like we have an agreement in principle there. Very good. All right. So, Richard, what did we learn tonight?
Oh, man, I don't know. I was just thoroughly entertained, but
me too.
I don't know what we learned. We learned that the value of a good BP.
Yes, and okay. I learned that I started playing video poker way too late, but I didn't. I have some juicy video poker stories, but they're from many years after that. All right, the South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. Every Monday in July, the South Point is offering double points on video poker and point multipliers on slots as well. There are no limits and no machines are excluded. All month long, the casino is holding a $600,000 Money Madness promotion. A progressive begins at $10,000 and must hit by $25,000. All players in the casino actively playing with a slot card in place are eligible to win. If you're playing when the jackpot hits, you receive the $20 in free slot play if you're not the lucky guy who gets the bonus itself. Then the progressive starts all over again at $10,000. Also, every day at 10 a.m., a $1,000 progressive begins and it must hit by $2,500. So if you're playing after 10 a.m., you're actually eligible for both progressives. On Thursdays from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., they have a $5,200 seniors slot tournament. Beginning Tuesday, September 10th, I'll be beginning my next semester of video poker classes at the South Point. The semester there is usually 10 weeks. This time it will be as well, except the semester will last 11 weeks and will be dark on October 8th. I will be on the NCL breakaway on that week. At the Palms, there are drawings at 8 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays with a theme of $100,000 fun in the sun. The first five winners are equal, and they choose game pieces that are somewhere between $800 and $7,000. Winners 6 through 10 receive $250 in either free play or cash. And then they're done. Fridays and Saturdays, between 8 p.m. and midnight, you receive five times drawing tickets for the subsequent drawings. The play, earn, and win drawings, not drawings, play, earn, and win promotions on Monday, Wednesday, Friday for the last half of the month have a theme of kickback and relax. Top prizes are a Kindle Fire, Tiffany lamp, rocking chair, and sunglasses. On videopoker.com, the monthly contest from now until the end of the month is Ultimate Aces. As usual in videopoker.com contest, dealt hands have a large part in determining the winner, so you're smartest to play triple double bonus. That has the most chances for a 4,000 coin hand, and also there's a multiplier in effect, as we'll explain shortly. Outside of the tournament conditions, Ultimate X is a 10 coin per line game where you earn multipliers if you are dealt one or more aces in the original hand. So 9999 ace is always worth more than 9999 king, because you'll receive a 2x or 5x multiplier or some other multiplier on the hand with the ace in it, even though the game itself doesn't return anymore. All right, so next week we are probably going to be having a tax expert. Is that your understanding, Richard?
I hope so. I've been chasing this guy. I just have not. I've traded a few emails with him. I just want to make sure that he actually really handles a number of professional gamblers, that he really understands the tax needs of professional gamblers. And until I can interview him personally, I don't want to book him. So I've gone through an intermediary who says that the guy knows what he's doing, but I just want to make sure before we book him. So I'm hoping that's what we have next week.
All right. And we have about 1 minute left. And also, very near future, we're going to be talking to somebody who has experience as a professional dice roller.
Controlled dice thrower. This is a guy who recorded 50,000 rolls. He had a crap table in his living room, which his wife really loved that.
Oh, imagine that, like those as much as backgammon tables, I bet.
Well, they're a little larger than backgammon tables, so yeah. So it should be interesting to hear his take on the whole controlled dice conversation.
Very good. When we had Stanford Wong on in our on the controlled dice, Wong on Dice book, apparently that has been the episode of our show that has been most downloaded by other people.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Kent Goulding. Thank you, Munch. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.